Welcome to episode 34 of Gallifrey Public Radio. After 40-some-odd years, the Ice Warriors are finally back, and we take time to discuss their reemergence in Cold War. But first, your hosts. I'm Jay Whitten.
We need somebody who is more intense.
And with me are Melissa Mazza.
Perfect Hoobian name.
And Keir Hansen.
I'm holding out for catfight.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But if we get into anything too serious, don't worry. We'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 34 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we really enjoy the sensation of walking around in cold, wet socks and shoes for 44 minutes. So, of course, we are underwater in a submarine for the episode Cold War. And as always, this is Melissa, accompanied by Jay and Keir. How are you guys tonight?
Very good.
Awesome.
So are you guys ready to talk about this soggy episode?
Yeah. I'm in essence really pleased that we got this episode right now on the heels of everything that happened over the last 2 weeks with the previous episodes. So yeah. I think this was just what the doctor ordered this week.
Yeah, I mean, this was just like the quintessential classic Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
It was the base under siege kind of thing. You know, it's very, very reminiscent of the Second Doctor. I mean, everything in here pretty much came out of a Second Doctor story.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, after getting such a wild departure from the norm, it was kind of refreshing to be like, okay, we remember where we're from, guys. Don't freak out. So.
Yeah.
We're good. We're good. But before we do get into the nitty gritty of this particular episode and a return of some, I'm reluctant to call them villains, return of adversaries that we haven't seen in a while. We do have some news that we can share, correct?
Yeah.
A little bit.
Take me through.
The first thing that we've got is actually a little bit of Tennant talking about being in the 50th anniversary. Just, you know, a couple quotes. He was saying that it's kind of weird being back, but at the same time, it's very refreshing. And so him just, you know, kind of answering some questions about being back on the set. Nothing real major. You know, we kind of figured this was going to happen once the series started, that we'd get a lot more news of the 50th now that they're not worried about detracting from the upcoming series.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We've got some rumors going around that we're going to see not only the Zygons, but the Daleks and the Cybermen in the 50th anniversary.
And I didn't think that was going to be. That was one of those kind of a bits of information. I said, "Well, okay, well that makes sense." I wasn't gonna flip out and start, you know, yelling from the rafters like I did about the Zygons, because that was something really unexpected.
Yeah.
Daleks and Cybermen, especially if you're going to have the two doctors that we have confirmed involved. Well, there you go.
Yeah,
that's, you know, who else are you going to stack up against them? Well, there's a couple people.
Right. And the person that we're getting this information from is Robert Banks Stewart, who is a writer for Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. And he, like, in the same breath that he says that the Zygons, the Daleks, and the Cybermen are in the episode, he says, "But no one yet knows what the plot of the 50th will be. Stephen Moffat and his team in Cardiff are quite rightly keeping it all secret."
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like, it's he giveth and he taketh away in this little bit of information. Like you said, like, we can expect that the Daleks and Cybermen will be there. The Zygons were, like, a particular point of information. But I don't think he really gave us anything new here.
I wonder if, you know, with this cone of silence that they've been maintaining for such a long time, up through the early casting processes and some of the early production, that they are not withholding the script in its entirety from everyone, save maybe your principal actors. So I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the crew, a lot of the, you know, the editors and things of that sort have no idea what the episode in its entirety is, for its own protection, so to speak.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like when the series was coming back and they used the anagram of Torchwood to to hide it and all. It's like, you know, 50th anniversary, Blue Harvest. You know, it's they're hiding a lot of stuff and doing a really good job about it. And I think that, you know, with the example that was set with the Neil Gaiman script popping up in a cab in London, that you know, our fandom wants to be surprised. You know, yes, we're scrambling for every bit of information that we can get, but at the same time, we're kind of reluctant to go digging further than we're supposed to.
Right, and a lot of people will clamor for confirmation before they start getting uppity about anything.
Yeah.
You know, what's the validity of your source? Oh, it's the sun? Never mind.
Yeah. So, the news that we are getting, it's minimal, but I kind of like it that way. Mm-hmm. So, and then we've also got some new pictures from the set. Nothing major, just it's the first confirmed photograph of David Tennant and Matt Smith together in costume. Just some new set photos and stuff, nothing major. But you can find all this stuff over in the show notes. Go to GallifreyPublicRadio.com/34, and they're all going to be in there. So we won't take too much time going into it.
Now, since you're mentioning the site there, you might as well also make mention of some of the housekeeping news that you wanted to share as well, Jay.
Yeah, while we're talking about it, if you're getting the feed through our old Podbean site, this is going to be the last episode that goes up on there. If you haven't switched over yet, now is the time to do it. Otherwise, this will be the end. We enjoyed having you. Bye. You know, but we feel like, you know, there's been plenty of time to switch over. So if you haven't done it before now, then you're a severe procrastinator, and I admire you for your determination.
Well done. Did you also have a bit of an update? We had some folks that were asking about the iTunes archives and how far back episodes go.
That should be resolved here within the next actually, they should all be available. It's getting kind of hinky trying to, because of the I won't go too much into the technical stuff, but trying to transfer the feed over to our new site, things kind of got shuffled and mixed around and stuff. So if they're not available right now, they should be within the next week. You should be able to go and get them all from iTunes. But they are all available on our website. You can just go to our site, and everything from episode one is available to download. So if you can't find them on iTunes, you can go and do it there.
Oh, just a really, really quick thing, because it sort of it built a little bit on what we were saying last week about some of the production photos that we weren't really sure. Is that really a photo from the set, or was that actually a cosplay shot that was taken from a, you know, second story building somewhere and things? And we were noting about the costumes on Smith.
Yeah,
and that it was, you know, it looked like the old tweed jacket. Oh well, just. So that you folks know, if you decide to go seeking the production photos from the set right now, you will note specifically and confirm that is definitely Matt Smith's face. He's definitely wearing a very particular suit, which puts us in a very particular time frame within the flow of episodes.
Yeah.
So seek it if you choose.
Yeah.
That's all.
Good way to put it, yes.
Yeah, I wasn't going to screw it. He's wearing a bikini or anything.
Yeah, they're there if you want to search them out. If not, you know, enjoy the surprise when it comes. Mm-hmm. So some of the other news that we've got, we've actually got Colin Baker, Sylvester McCoy, and Paul McGann are all backing the idea of getting Peter Jackson to direct an episode of Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. So... this has gone well beyond the realm of somebody making an offhand comment on Twitter to
be great.
People really getting behind it. I mean, this is like, you know, when Nathan Fillion said that if he won the lottery, he would, you know, buy the rights to Firefly, and like, you know, people just clamored to send him money and everything. I mean, that's the level that this is getting to. People are getting behind it and really starting to support the idea.
If it were anything that were monetarily involved, you'd see a Kickstarter program start up within seconds.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Both of these organizations, both BBC Wales and Mr. Jackson themselves, have more money than God, so it's really not a concern of cash. It's just a matter of finding the opportunity And have we gotten any sort of a word back from Jackson's camp, from Wingnut, about whether or not he's keen on the prospect?
The most recent thing we've heard from them is that he said that right now he's really busy with The Hobbit, getting that out, getting that, you know, publicized and everything like that. So it's, if we do see it, obviously it's not going to be in Series 7. It probably wouldn't even be in Series 8 unless it was in the, you know, the very latter part of that series. So it's up in the air. I mean, he's still saying that he wants to do it. I mean, it's still a dream of his to actually do it. But he said right now there's just no way to fit their schedule in with his.
Hopefully he's lying like Billy Piper.
Let the mashup prospects begin.
And then we've also got a little bit of news about the new Cybermen, which these get a little bit spoilery. So I think instead of bringing them up and talking about them, we will link to the story in the show notes. If you want to go and find out a little bit more, you know, feel free. They're over there, but these are just a little bit too specific for me to feel comfortable throwing out there right now. So,
okay,
we're getting better, folks. We've promised.
We're trying.
Yeah, no, and again, these aren't even. It's very minor detail. So the fact that we're giving you the spoiler tag for this is, you know, they're not like life changing revelations.
Yeah, but it is stuff. It's coming from Nicholas Briggs, you know, and these are basically definite things coming up. So, yeah, it's just a little bit too close to the line there to really, you know, skirt the issue. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that about does it for our news.
Yeah. Yep. So. Things will continue to emerge over the next couple of weeks. I would expect now that they are into the thick of both their primary and secondary set location shoots, we're going to start getting some tidbits of people spotted on location. So expect some of your ancillary characters to be confirmed, people that have not yet been discussed. You will start seeing shots of them in costume, wandering the set, or jumping in and out of trailers, or things of that sort. So,
yeah. So if you're really trying to avoid spoilers and really don't want to know anything about the 50th anniversary, now's the time to crawl into your cave and shut off everything.
Or just take all of your information directly from BBC sources and don't look.
Even
to the
they give. I mean, honestly, I got a lot of the news for this week from the BBC site and felt some of it was kind of spoilery. So even they are giving out these things that some people might want to. You're right. Just crawl under a rock. Come out when it's safe.
And now it's time for Little Whovians. All right. So Mikey, how old are you?
10, almost 11.
All right. And how long have you been watching Doctor Who?
I think 3 years. I know two.
All right, and who's your favorite doctor?
11th.
So you just got done watching the Cold War, right? What did you think about the Ice Warriors?
I thought they were cool.
Now, did you know that they were a classic villain, that they came beforehand?
No.
Do you think that they're a good villain for the doctor nowadays, or do you think that they're kind of weak?
I think they're a good doctor for now.
Okay, what was your favorite part about this episode?
The part about the Hads.
All right, thank you.
So today we are talking about Cold War.
Yeah, we're going ahead to the past.
Exactly. So this takes place in 1983, and I like that it was something, you know, it's something that we can, it's the immediate past, so it's historical, but not quite, you know, it's somewhat relatable or whatever. So to jump right into it, I think that I liked that it was all action. Like, you start right away from, you know, action to action, and the episode felt quite short because it was just this one story getting resolved. Mm-hmm. What did you guys think of that? Because at the beginning it was kind of weird, like they think they're going to Vegas or something, and then suddenly, oh no, they're on a submarine, and right. And the doctor goes right away from Viva Las Vegas, like he says that to, oh, like you need to do this, this, and this to fix your submarine. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, as Jay was saying, this is I'm not going to say classic Who, but this is a cookie cutter as far as, yeah, some of the things we would expect. The unplanned arrival, you know, the left turn at Albuquerque kind of approach. And yet you still get that spur of the moment. Okay, well, different situation. Great, let's go. And it's just the adventure of the moment. So that is a black and white Doctor Who as far as we know it. Without getting hung up on some of the little nitpicky things, of which I live for the nitpicky things. But I do like their choice of time period in the within the viewer's lifespan sort of past. We're not going back necessarily to the First World War. We're not going back beyond anything that is a recognizable touch point for a lot of the viewing audience, or I should say any of the viewing audience over the age of 30 or so, maybe the mid-20s, because it still keeps it fresh enough for our companion, which yeah. I think is an important factor.
I know a lot of people, myself included, to a lesser degree, just really felt their age in this episode when you know the Doctor had to explain the Cold War to Clara, and you're just kind of like, that wasn't... Oh, wait, that was like 30, 40 years ago. Dang, never mind.
Or all the 80s band references.
Yeah.
No, big shout out to Duran Duran. Thank you very much.
Oh yeah, I actually had to go while we were watching it. I had to stop and check. I pulled out my phone. I'm like, wait a minute, what year did Hunger Like a Wolf come out? Did they get that right? It came out in 82, so it would have been out and had time to get over
peak of popularity.
I never knew who sang that song, so I learned something. Duran Duran.
Wow. Okay. Talk about showing your age. All right. moving on.
They really did play up the monster movie theme in this kind of thing too. I mean, it was very much you don't see the villain; it's always around the corner, or you're hearing the sounds and things like that. And they never show you while he's out of his armor.
Mm. You know, love that constantly recurrent hissing, clicking kind of noise that they had given to Skaldak this time.
As opposed to making everything he says hiss.
Yeah, playing up the reptilian aspect of it. Interesting, though, that the last time we had seen Grand Marshal Skaldak, he was one of the only ones of his species that didn't speak quite that way. Mm. I'm wondering if they... this time around, because he was a little bit more raspy and so forth, I think you can chalk that up to being trapped in a block of ice for 5,000 years. But a lot of people from the moment they were starting to watch this, and I was just sort of tapping into Twitter every once in a while. I didn't want to get too invested in or getting muddled by people's reactions before I had a chance to react myself, but. The few things I was getting right off the bat was, wow, the update on the Ice Warriors looks really good. And that was before they even saw, you know, the great reveal of him mm-hmm. out of the armor. But just the way that they had treated the biomechanical armor in the first place was just
so
really
yeah,
tough.
I've never seen any classic Ice Warrior episodes. Do they ever show them outside of their armor?
Nope. And I really think that was how Gatiss sold this episode to Moffat, because you know Moffat didn't want to ever bring the Ice Warriors back. He thought they were the epitome of bad Doctor Who villains, and I think that's what Gatiss did. Was he was like, no, look, I'm going to take him out of the armor. I'm going to turn it into a monster movie, and I'm going to bring him out of the armor. And Moffat was had his interest peaked at that point. Goes, okay, let's do it.
Go on.
I seriously think that was the selling point that Gatiss used.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah. So, I mean, this was a Gatiss episode. It's good that you bring that up. For that alone, some people might be judging it a little bit harshly. But I want to talk about it. It was also good that it was just one dude. Like, it wasn't, you know, a whole army of Ice Warriors or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, they hinted that there were more of them, but that you never actually see them. And, I personally liked that. What did you guys think of that?
I think with this particular... counterpart or adversary, and I don't want to call them villains, because if you go back a lot of the times that both in the last time we actually saw them, you know, you're going back to Third Doctor at that point, or even the mentions that they were getting along the way in things like Waters of Mars and so forth, the Doctor had been referring to them as being so honorable, you know, and it was reminding me quite a bit of a very Klingon-esque culture, you know, military rankings, establishing their caste system. They were part of their naming was their rank. Their rank was part of their nomenclature and things of that sort. So it was, you know, they were this very noble, honorable, but bloodthirsty species. And the fact that they were doing the trapped in a tin can sort of episode with a single one, and yet the threat level was still that high, just spoke volumes about them.
Yeah. And that there were some really, really good points, and there were also some sticking points too. I mean, that everything about this just screamed, you know, sub cliche.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
They didn't push that envelope very far. I mean, it was everything that you come to expect about a sub story, you know, like, Soleil wrote in and he was talking about some of the things that stuck out to him. And he was saying, you know, the submarine is sinking uncontrollably as an ensign reads off the depth meter by meter. You know, the submarine lands on a ledge hanging precariously. Mm-hmm. The pressure so great that it may implode and you hear creaking the whole time to remind you of it. You know, you come really close to launching the missile but don't quite get there. And, you know, you get the second in command who is, you know, a pain in the captain's ass and, you know, to the point of selling him out. So it's...
Yep. It's every, if you want to categorize them as periscope tropes, you could possibly utilize.
I like what Soleil says. It's like Crimson Tide, Hunt for Red October, and Dust Boot hooks up with the same woman and she got pregnant. And then, 9 months later, it's a baby born in the room resembles all of them.
Yeah,
exactly. But it's a baby from V.
I mean, that was, aside from that, though, I mean, they were... You know, the TARDIS just, or, you know, Doctor not realizing where he's landing the TARDIS is getting a little bit old. You know, it's like we've seen it time and time and time and time again. And it's just, it's getting to the point where it's like, really, you know, you've had the TARDIS for how many hundreds of years now and you still don't know what to do with it.
Mm.
That whole excuse is getting kind of thin.
Well, that also goes along with the whole... they had to come up with a reason for the TARDIS not to be available to them for their their quick escape. So the whole pulling the HADS card.
Yeah, but I mean that just, you know, a technology that we haven't seen in close to 40 years, if not over 40 years. It was like, that's, you know, you might as well just come up with something completely new. You know, have a beam fall in front of it so you can't get into it or something. It's you know, come up with something other than, hey, remember this from, you know, 4 decades ago?
Right.
It just seemed a little bit too, you know, easy, really.
Well, if you get criticized for making up technology on the fly, the only way that you can avoid that is go and grab some of the made-up technology that you made up a while ago, and at least you can say, hey, used it before.
It would have seemed more... It wouldn't have seemed so out of place had they used it at any point in the last 40 years. You know, it's just the fact that it's such an old reference to bring up now that it's like, oh, yeah, no, I started playing with this thing that, you know, we haven't even mentioned for this long yet. It was just a little bit too jarring, really.
I mean, sometimes they can do that and pull it off and you're like, oh, but this was just, it was thrown in there.
It was just because it was such an obvious plot device of like, we got to get rid of the TARDIS. Here, let's throw this in. You know, if it hadn't been so completely obvious, then it wouldn't have been as bad.
Yeah. But, well, then that brings up another point as far as using or not using devices that they've used in the past. This is now the second week in a row that I'm wondering what the heck is going on with the translation matrix.
It seems to be working for Clara this week.
Yeah. It's working, but the TARDIS left. Hello? It went to the South Pole.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't think you need to be, like, in the TARDIS for it to work.
No, I mean,
but it has to be in the vicinity.
Well, I mean, if you look at, I mean, in let's say Angels Take Manhattan, when, you know, Rory is in the mobster guy's house and he's able to read the stuff on the Ming vase. You know, the TARDIS is miles and miles away and he's still able to pick up the, even the, you know, the written translation. So it's like they play with that an awful lot. You know, and so they've never said, oh, this is the defined characteristics of the translation matrix. It's, you're just supposed to accept that it's there and it works when you need it to. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any major plot point in that. I think it's just that, you know, this is the first time that they've had to explain it to Clara.
Right. And yet they did not explain to her the fact that even with such perfect translation, everybody speaks with perfect British accents and not a hint of a Russian accent among them. Not
none of them even looked like Russians.
No. I don't know. Davos could have been, maybe. I don't even remember what his character's name was. I know he's Davos.
First of all, my fandoms are getting really confused because the whole time I was thinking Davos and Edmure Tully. He was in this episode of Game of Thrones. Tobias Menzies from Rome. Yeah.
Yeah.
And once again, playing a screw up, like he seems to ruin everything in every show that he's in. Did you guys watch Rome on HBO?
Yeah. And it took me, I was about 5 minutes into this episode when I said, wait, no. That's that jack off from Rome.
He's also Patlin's brother on Game of Thrones.
Yeah. My 10-year-old was actually sitting there watching it, and it wasn't that he recognized him. He was like, wait, isn't that the best friend from Ferris Bueller? Like, close, but not quite. No. I mean, I could see where he got it from, but I was like, yeah, no, that guy's not that young anymore.
It's the jaw. It's that jaw thing.
Yeah.
But it all in all, you know what? I know, as people are saying, how tropey the episode was and how there were a lot of very convenient aspects thrown in to sort of keep it propelling forward. This was, off the cuff, this was the kind of episode I was expecting last week. You know, just an encapsulated little adventure.
So they should be past it by this episode. So they should be past this kind of thing by this episode.
Well, yeah. But it was a complete break from the What's Clara debacle. Yeah. A complete break. In fact, I don't think we got a thing.
No, the closest we got was when the professor. Can we just say David Warner? I mean, they completely should have made this episode all about him.
He was great.
I mean, they really dropped the ball on that one. You can't have an actor like David Warner in there and not give him, like, all the screen time. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the closest we get to finding anything out about him is when he was asking Clara, you know, it's like, what do you like to do? And she's too freaked out to respond. And she's like, oh, yeah, you know, stuff. I like to do stuff. And that's the closest we get to any new information on her.
Was thinking, like, okay, so I just watched this episode for the first time just a couple hours ago. Like, sometimes, unfortunately, life gets in the way of my television habits, and it sucks.
I have no idea.
So this is just, like, my off-the-cuff opinion, but I was getting really annoyed at Clara at this point, because I'm like, you know, Rose Tyler, her whole thing was that she was so normal, and that was what made her a great companion. This girl is normal, but in a boring way, because we've already been given her, like, you know, she's the impossible girl and whatever. So we're expecting so much more from her. And in this episode, not only is she not that impossible girl, but she's so normal that she's just, like, can't even answer questions that these people are, you know, like, I was expecting her to start singing Hungry Like the Wolf, like, you know, a long time before she actually does. Because, you know, she just doesn't show enough personality until then, in my opinion.
I think that... This was actually I love this episode for developing Clara, because you see her, you know, they're on the Soviet submarine and it doesn't phase her. She's just like, all right, cool. We're, you know, new adventure, whatever. And then when somebody has to go in to see Skaldak, you know, she volunteers. She's like, yeah, you know, I'll go in there. It's fine. And she's in there. She doesn't have a problem with it. And then, you know, she realizes that he's out of there. And she starts to get a little bit freaked out, but then as soon as she's out, she's laughing and she's, you know, talking to the doctor again. Mm-hmm. But then she sees the bodies or the remains, and everything just comes to a screeching halt. At that moment, you see in her, I mean, Jenna Louise Coleman did a great job, because you see in her face, she's like, wait a minute, stuff just got real. Mm-hmm. And she is not the same from that moment on. You really see, like, it's gone from, hey, I'm going on adventures, to, wait a minute, I am in danger. And, you know, the doctor says, you know, stay here. And she's like, okay. She's like, no, I mean it. Stay here. I said, okay. Yeah, and she's not trying to run off with him. And it really showed that, you know, she's getting scared now. And she's realizing the gravity of the situation she's in. And I thought it was a great personalizing moment for her.
I actually saw that moment as, she's very needy, because there's another point in the episode where she's like, how did I do? And the doctor says it wasn't a test. And she's like, okay, well, how did I do? Like, and it's like, you know, God, Clara, shut up. It's not about you. Like, this episode's about these other people today. Like,
yeah.
That's what I got.
Right. No, that's valid. I mean, that look for, or that want for validation from him is one of the only things that she ever seems to seek out. You know, she toys with him. She needles him from time to time. But when there's something that she needs, it usually has to be something that reassures her. So that's a very telling personality trait. Or maybe it's just, you know, the sort of the way that that Jenna's playing this up. But speaking of, in terms of portrayal, your take on the doctor's behavior through this episode, much less Shaggy Scooby,
yeah,
doctor. Lots of nice little tributes to past regenerations as well.
Mm-hmm.
The pocket full of junk when he gets frisked.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That's second doctor all over.
Oh, absolutely.
This is a,
what's
very
with the Barbie doll?
I know. I was wondering what the deal was with that.
He was as happy to see that as his screwdriver when he got him back.
Yeah.
I didn't get that either. But that Barbie doll is from around that time, the 1983.
Yeah, but he's not.
I think that the fact that they, you know, threw it in there, it's either something that wound up on the cutting room floor, or it's something that we've got coming up. They're going to either reveal what it is soon.
The significance of the Barbie doll. It's more, yeah, important than the leaf.
Or it's just something that Gatiss put in there, and it was supposed to be, you know, a big thing or a joke or something like that, and it just got cut out, and that was something that was a leftover. This is the second time, though, that the doctor has he didn't lose his screwdriver in the last one, but, you know, it was like there was the possibility of him giving it away, or I don't know, what am I trying to say here? Like, you know, they made a point of showing that he would not give his screwdriver away.
Right.
And then when they go to take it away from him, he's like, I want a receipt. You know, he's like, he's freaked out that they're taking it from him. So it's like, what are they getting at here with the screwdriver? I mean, this is two episodes in a row that he's been, they've showcased how much
they have been far more reliant on it lately than they have in the past, even within 11th Doctor. I mean, they are really, talk about overusing the tool. I'm amazed they have not gotten to the point where someone has called him out and said, you know, can you function without that thing? I mean, because
he wouldn't be much of a wizard without his magic wand, though.
But he's gone through entire regenerations without using a sonic screwdriver.
I know.
And now he cracks that thing out like a garage door opener every time he comes into another room. Oh, hold on, I got this.
He literally did that in the last episode, like a garage door opener.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's got his sonic screwdriver more than Jeff Winger has his cell phone. You know, it's getting to the point where it's getting stupid, but...
Did you notice that it glowed red this week, though? Has it ever done that before?
It was in self-destruct mode there.
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing I wrote down. It was weird because, I mean, it stood out so much. But I think the colors of the lighting in this episode were brilliant. I mean, the whole time you feel cold. Yeah, the lighting was very cold, very blue. And then, you know, right up until the end at the... when they're on the bridge and Skaldak is getting ready to fire the missiles, and then you get all the warm, intense colors coming in, you know, all the reds and everything like that.
The red alert sort of a feel.
Yep. Yeah. So, the lighting in this was brilliant. And also, the music was very, very subtle. And I was actually, I had to make a mental note to pay attention to it the second time I watched it, because it's very easy to miss it, but it's so brilliantly done in this episode.
I wonder if they might have learned their lesson very quickly and done some fast remastering based on a lot of the feedback they got last week about the levels and the sound levels in the music for Akaten being so overpowering that it was upstaging the dialogue in a lot of cases.
Yeah, it's very possible. I thought the music was just brilliantly done in this episode. Mm.
Now,
I didn't pay much attention to it. I only watched it a couple hours ago.
And that's fine. That actually says something because obviously we notice when it's not there, when it's completely absent. But when it becomes a part of the audiovisual atmosphere, or is that sort of that quiet driver that moves you through, that's very effective in certain instances. I mean, granted, we have our tense moments where it starts to build up and okay, all right, we've got the bumpa bumpa drums because this is a bumpa bumpa moment. But it was really very subdued, which goes along with that idea of the claustrophobia, the idea that we're facing a potential suffocation and everything's kind of closing in. So I think that was a conscious decision. But yeah, I agree with you, Jay. Very effective in this case. Let me ask this. Mm-hmm. So, if you're not terribly familiar with the fact that the Ice Warriors were a return adversary for the Doctor, did that play well? And Melissa, I'm speaking specifically to you on this.
Okay.
In terms of Smith's reaction when he realizes, A, that they've got an Ice Warrior on board, and B, when he finds out his identity.
I mean, I thought he played it really well in the scene itself. Like, he starts to realize before anyone else that it's an Ice Warrior. And obviously he knows what that is. And he admits that he has a history with them. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they say the name, Saldek, or however you pronounce it, he knows who that is. And he has this great level of respect for him. And that definitely comes across. However, I think in the rest of the episode, it was they almost abandoned that. They should, in my opinion, they should have done more with the Doctor and the Ice Warrior interacting. I liked those points and where Clara was their go-between and whatever. I think they spent a lot of time, it kills some of the people on the ship and whatever. That time could have been spent more with the Doctor. I know that the Ice Warriors are this, old adversary of his. I would have liked a little bit more history from his point of view.
Right. No, I understand that completely. And that's what I kind of figured would end up playing across, because it could have ended up pulling quite a bit of focus away from the momentum of the episode to start getting into their interpersonal history. But I don't know. I would think that that to a certain degree, when you drop a name like that, and they kind of write it off very quickly, saying, "Oh, well, he was considered to be one of the greatest warriors of their times. They tattoo his name on their flesh before they die, and things of that sort." And that's all a nice little send up, and all. But there was the name actually had been referenced before. That was the aspect that I was hoping they were going to at least give a little bit of mention to, the fact that the last time that Skaldak was believed dead, along with his entire I forget what they're not platoons, they're not for whatever their organization is, that military function, but the idea of him being trapped for 5,000 years, you want to know exactly what had happened at that point that got him trapped there. How did he end up with the fleet that he was with prior, and his daughter? How did he end up being the sole survivor out of that instance? Mm-hmm. I thought that would have been something that the Doctor could have tapped into because of all of his knowledge of the past and how they've interacted over the millennia.
Has there ever been? Because again, I've never seen any other Ice Warrior episodes. He mentions his daughter. Is that something from Classic Who, or is that completely?
No, I think they added that element in. It was interesting, though. I think that's a nice modernization to put in the fact that within this this very militant society, that there were just as noble and fierce and eager to fight female warriors as there were male, and that it was something where you brought your children up to follow you into battle, not just, you know, I bring my sons, my firstborn son, or anything of that sort. So I think that was a an important thing to note in the way they decided to update this species.
Yeah,
I think they're trying to make every classic Who creature like scary again, and this is just another way to do it. Like, we've seen this face now outside of, you know, outside of the armor. I'm sure it used to be, they never said that was armor. That was probably assumed to be their outer, you know,
right, or spacesuits to allow them to. They did a nice job. Granted, Smith was delivering his exposition lines outrageously quickly in this episode. And I noted this out to some folks, and they said, oh, that's just because, you know, General Louise Coleman has said in a number of interviews that she's a fast talker, and it probably just causes everybody else to do a lot of the same. Well, any director worth their salt is going to step forward and say, okay, what, I've got everybody now talking at 65 miles an hour. Can at least those of you who are capable of slowing it down, please do so? For the sake of you know, legibility or what have you. But in Smith's case, he was rattling through this whole explanation of the armor and the species and the this and the that, and he banged through what was probably a half a page of information in about 32 seconds. So I even wanted to go back and capture a lot of that as well. But he even catches himself saying, look, you've got me talking about them, and I told you there's no time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's... That was it. It was just they were trying to pace the episode quickly to, you know, make it feel like everything was in a rush and they had to get it done and give you that sense of urgency. And also, you know, it's like you don't want to listen to Matt Smith, you know, give exposition for 5 minutes at a time. You know, you're trying to get it through so that you can, you know, people can hear it, they can understand it and move on to the next scene, you know, so that it doesn't get bogged down with history lessons.
I'd rather that be revealed over the course of conversation.
Mm-hmm. Not so much exposition, yeah.
Exactly, just standing there and saying, taking a deep breath, and okay, there was a species, they were here from 5,000 years ago, and they've been around and scattered across the universe in small pockets. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it. But the most important thing that was part of that entire, you know, word spew was the fact that the armor was... biomechanical. So it had, it was setting up the possibility that he could step out of it and have it function on its own.
Yeah.
So throw that out there too quickly, you're going to lose some folks.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I think that it was just a, it was a decision based on the fact that they felt the episode needed to have a sense of urgency.
Okay.
Yeah. It was that given the fact that it was written by Mark Gatiss and that Douglas MacKinnon was directing it, we've seen some stuff from him and it's been fantastic. But given the pedigree of those two, I think it was a conscious decision to say, okay, we need to put this information in there, but we need to get it out of the way quickly so it doesn't slow it down. Yeah, I think that it was a choice of the lesser of two evils. And they said, okay, we're going to sacrifice some of the, you know, comprehension for the pacing of the episode.
Mm-hmm. That's valid.
Yeah.
I will say though that, you know, and again, it goes back to the mentions that we had gotten within the last, last couple of doctors of the warriors themselves, though we haven't seen them, and the fact that they were being, you know, always described as, well, say what you will about them, they're you know, this. There's honor among them, and they take their they take their jobs very seriously. But from the moment Smith realizes what's on board, he doesn't recognize it as a threat until it actually becomes one. And his points are very clear as he's scolding the rest of these Russian naval crew that they brought this on themselves. Skaldak would have walked away.
Yeah.
And he keeps hammering that point home, which is why, you know, I like the way that they button this up and the fact that he kind of salutes them as he sees them off the off the deck of the ship. Because it means that if we do end up running into them again, you don't really know, you know, if we had another Pandorica kind of gathering of baddies, I don't know necessarily that you would see the Ice Warriors among them anymore.
Yeah.
Nice. Which is an interesting flip. It doesn't happen often that you actually get to defuse, you know, these old adversaries. I don't know if he's effectively done it or not.
Well, yeah, so. I mean they put it in a nice way to where they could come in on either side of the fence. You know, it could be that they come back as villains, or they could possibly come back as, oh, hey, you're here fighting this this main bad guy too. You know, and just battlefield compatriots, basically.
Right.
So, I mean, they could go either way with it, the way that they ended it, and I think that that's brilliant. You know, I do like the fact that they demonstrated that these guys are military at its finest. You know, they're with the Doctor explaining it and the little bit that we saw from Skaldak, that these guys are what the Santarans are supposed to be.
Yeah. No, that's valid. I mean, I keep seeing them, and I'm going Klingon with this. You know, I'm jumping universes, but it seems to be one of the closest things without being quite as violent, but as far as their military prowess and the importance of that role and function within their society,
their discipline, or being the
exactly, they just don't happen to, you know, bludgeon each other as a sign of affection.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, all in all, I think this was a very good episode.
Yeah, I liked it.
It went back to, you know, the old school Doctor Who, and it, you know, everyone that was offended by last week's episode got their Band-Aid and you know, and I think it did a good job of, if not explaining everything to people that were new to the Ice Warriors, at least giving them enough to get through this one and enjoy it.
Yeah. And they don't necessarily have to go back. If you do try to go back and get some of the second and third Doctor episodes to give you more exposure to the Ice Warriors, this isn't going to throw you. I mean, this is not, they did justice to it without, while still finding something new to do that was acceptable within the confines of this episode. You know, the whole idea of, you know, are you the last of your kind? And God only knows, you know, Doctor Who has played with the last of your kind trope a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's one of those things that, especially when it's coming from the Doctor, that sort of a discussion bears more weight than, you know, than anyone else delivering that kind of a, I know how you feel sort of discussion. I did find it kind of interesting, though, that and maybe this was something that they were sort of trying to writing into their culture, that anytime the warrior that Skaldak was talking about his people of his past, whether it be his fellow soldiers or his daughter or, you know, his family, his loved ones, they kept using the reference to dust.
Yeah,
they've gone to dust. And I thought, well, okay, that's a very Martian way of putting it, I suppose.
Yeah. I've heard this one compared a lot to the episode Dalek. You know, you get the last of its kind up against the Doctor in a, you know, enclosed kind of setting. You know, people that are completely ineffective, you know, fighting against it.
Mm-hmm. And at times exacerbating the situation.
Yeah.
Through their own, well, lack of listening. You know, I told you not to do that. You did it anyway.
Now look what you did. Yeah. And I think that, just like in Dalek, Matt Smith's dedication to it is what really sold the Ice Warrior. Because, I mean, let's face it, this could be a Power Ranger villain, and yeah, it could be horrible. But I think it was Matt Smith's dedication to his performance that really sold it. Just like Eccleston's in Dalek, you know, you see the Dalek and you're like, "What the heck is that thing? Really, that's going to be the?" But you know, Eccleston's performance really sold it, and I felt the same way with this one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I think it, because we did note that this was a less of a runaround, you know, zoinks, we got, you know, trouble ahead kind of a goofiness factor from Smith, and he did tone it down considerably and sort of treat it with a little more gravity. I think it worked better.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that the crew themselves are going to start to realize that unless it's really warranted, it is better at times to play that down.
Yeah.
Now, there's times when you do want to have, you know, Smith being the young doctor that he is, and having the, you know, the hip whiz bang time.
There are definitely episodes that play to that, but then there are episodes like this that, you know, you really do want the intensity ratcheted up quite a bit.
I think he's definitely evolving into the role. I was concerned about it last season. I'm getting, you know, I'm getting more from him this season that proves to me, you know, in moments here and there, whether they be the interrogation moments, whether it be the talking you down off the ledge kind of moments, or the Sermon on the Mount moments, or whatever they are that are showing that he's rising to meet the demands of the complexity that the doctor's character really requires. So, not calling him my favorite, but he's definitely
improved. Yeah,
yeah, he noted improvements.
Although, you know, even though we don't have the cartoony doctor as much this week, I did notice, and you know, Kier, you complained about the doctor sliding around all over the place and whatnot. In this episode, he actually managed to slide over diamond plating floor.
Yes.
I was like, how do you pull that off? I mean, this stuff is designed to grip.
Frictionless shoes.
Yeah. I saw that and I was like, oh, Kier's going to be pissed.
Nope. I'm going to let it go. I'm going to let it go because it's one of those things where they're going to put him on a gravel beach and he's going to slide for 20 feet.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's like watching James Bond movies where they're chasing each other around on dirt roads and their tires are squealing. You know, you just, after a while, you just let it go. Whatever.
Now watch, we're going to get an episode where they like actually put him on roller skates and he just winds up falling over.
Exactly. Yeah. He's useless on four wheels.
It's like, oh, we're on the ice planet. And, you know, he's got perfect traction the entire time.
That would be great. They took him to an ice planet, and he comes to do his slide maneuver and just falls right out of frame. No, he just keeps going.
Okay, there you go.
Comedy gold. Well, as much as this was a nice little, you know, no pun intended, a canned episode. Okay, the pun was intended. And the fact that we really didn't get any furthering of the Clara line, we didn't get any more into our, you know, what I'm hoping to see more of my great intelligence theory played out over time and things. Next week, another period, well, a period piece.
Period-ish.
Yeah. You know, it's your it's your Paranormal Activity episode, I guess. Looks like we are going to start to get a little bit more. And I'm hoping that they do it in small doses. Yeah. And not sort of treat it as the first half of the episode is the doctor, you know, similar to what we had with Akaten. First half of the episode is the doctor trying to go, oh, what is this girl all about? Oh, there's a plot to pursue. Oh, and then they run off and handle the ghost story.
Yeah, or the other way of doing it is completely ignore it until like the last episode, and it's like, oh, here's all your answers.
Yeah, throw it all in. But we do have the one line from the trailer for Hyde, where he asks, "What is she?" He's, Clara, what is she? Now,
I hope it's about Clara, and they're not just saying, you know, making you think that he's talking about her.
Well, what I was thinking about this is knowing the way that they've toyed with us and the way that they cut their trailers and some of the things they put in their promo posters and things like that to lead us down the wrong path, it could very well have been he was talking about a different female character entirely, and he's turning to Clara and saying, Clara, what is she? I would not be surprised if that was the case.
Yeah. I seriously think that's the way that it's going to wind up going, but Mm. We'll see. I don't know. I mean, it looks, you know, they've touted this as being a good old fashioned scary ghost story, and from everything I'm seeing about it, they know what they're talking about. I mean, okay. it looks like it's gonna be good.
Well, then it's gonna, in my estimation, just because of the way that I end up watching a lot of these episodes, and especially if you're going for scare factor in that regard, to me, the onus falls on Murray Gold's shoulders.
Oh yeah.
The music is going to have to define this episode for me personally, because we've all seen 1,001 of these kind of ghost stories or what have you, the haunted house, you know, whatever you're going to, however you're going to take the angle. But man, I'm telling you, the music's got to sell it.
The music is definitely the forefront, but I think the entire audio experience, you know, just the sound effects, the Foley have to be on par too. Mm-hmm. You know, the music is really going to set the scene, but you can have the greatest music in the world and a goofy ooh sound effect is going to ruin it. So it's the whole audio experience is going to have to be good.
Yeah. So, well, I hope so.
We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah. But how many more episodes are left in the season, by the way?
We've got 5 more after this one.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So, right. Yeah, we're coming up on the. I mean, we've still got more ahead of us than we do behind, but yeah, we'll see how it works.
Yeah. Well, as far as I'm concerned, we're just at this point we're counting down to gaming. That's. Yeah. Let's be realistic here.
That's what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, we've got some nice stops in between, but yeah, that's kind of the destination at this point. Mm-hmm.
And then after that, it's just, you know, the e-brake is off and you're just careening downhill towards the finale as far as I'm concerned.
All right.
But again, very big thanks to the fact that we are continuing to get some valid feedback through Twitter, through our episode comments, through the iTunes comments, through direct emails to us on the feedback address for Gallifrey Public Radio. It's invaluable.
Oh yeah, to us. Absolutely.
And it also really steers a lot of our conversation as we're putting the notes together too, because it lets us know, you know, what things are really starting to stand out in your opinions as they differ from the, you know, all of the various forums and networks and places where other people can sound off. We want to hear from the folks that think as we do and that share with us on a regular basis. So it is invaluable information, and we highly encourage you to get more people into the mix as well, because okay. There's nothing we love more than demanding that Jay check the email address more.
Yeah. Give me more work, please. I'm bored. But yeah, thanks to everybody. Yeah, like Kira mentioned, you can find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, the feedback at GallifreyPublicRadio.com. You know, we're on Facebook, iTunes, GallifreyPublicRadio.com. Leave comments there. Just anywhere you can, you know, get into the discussion. I mean, we've got a lot of great topics going on, so yeah, get into it any way you can. So,
please.
All right. Well, this has been episode 34 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, curiosity, please send us pictures of the Ice Warriors.
Nice. And this is Melissa saying, glowing red sonic screwdriver. All right.
And this is Kira saying, if you didn't know the song Vienna by Audiovox, go grab it. It is actually a good tune.
See you guys next week.
Bye. Ciao.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. Have something you need to say, something we got wrong, or something you just need to weigh in on? Send us an email at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. You can also find us on Twitter at Gallifrey Radio, on Stitcher Smart Radio under Gallifrey Public Radio. Find us on iTunes, where you can leave us comments and reviews. You can also head over to our homepage at gallifreypublicradio.com, where you can leave comments on each episode and get into discussions on the things that we bring up. You can also keep up to date on all the latest news and what's going on in the community. Music by Beyond the Epilogue and Retcon Addict.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2013.